our topic is about minhagim. And the reason I really wanted to start with a topic such as minhagim of customs is because it's very central to our lives as individuals. Many of us often feel our lives are governed in some way by Jewish custom. The broader Jewish community is very much governed, as we're going to see over the coming weeks, very much governed by customs of the past. And at the same time, obviously, in our shul, one of the questions that we are facing in our shul is striking a delicate balance between adhering to the customs of previous generations of the shul, but at the same time trying to notice or pay attention to things that we do that may not actually be ancient customs of our shul, but things that kind of crept in over time. And the question is, we refer to both of those with the term minhag, so we're trying to kind of understand and get a bit of a sense of what do we mean by the term minhag. And I just want to begin with a story. A few years ago, I was back visiting Manchester, and I was in shul for the Shabbat, and during Hagbah, the person lifts the Sefer Torah, and everyone, you know, does the thing with their little finger and points at the Sefer Torah. And this guy who was in front of me turns to the person next to him and is like, you know why we do that? Minhag. And the derision with which he said that word was, this person does not like minhagim. It might have been it was close to Pesach, where kitniot, the observance of kitniot, one of the strongest minhagim, was on his mind, and thus he was particularly angry at minhagim. But he seemed to really not like the notion of minhagim. And the truth is that he would find a good amount of support for that view within Jewish sources, within Jewish tradition. If you take a look at source number one on the source sheets, for those people may need to share source sheets, it's on a teshuvah, a responsa from Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson, one of the most significant halachic authorities of Jewish history, says the following right at the end of this response about related to minhagim. Minhag ze gehinam lemafreya. He points out that minhag, the word minhag, is an anagram of the word gehinam, of hell. So we clearly gain an indication of a certain viewpoint here of when someone talks about something being a minhag. Rabbeinu Tam has no qualms with saying, yeah, but minhag's an anagram of Gehenna. And when some people reacted to my titling sacred practice or stupid custom, they were like, stupid custom seems a bit harsh. I was like, well, Rabbeinu Tam describes it as an anagram of Gehenna, of an anagram of hell. So, you know, it's not exactly like I'm overstepping the mark too much here. But as much as we have those kinds of sources which seem to treat minhagim with such contempt, we also have sources like source number two. This is from the Rashba, another one of the medieval Rishonim, also in a responsa, dealing with an issue regarding customs. And he says the following in source number two. Uminhagim shal kihilot torahi. That the customs of a community are Torah. It's pretty hard, you know, that's not mincing his words. Uvechol kiyotzi bazeh yesh lomar minhag mevatel halacha. And minhagim need to be treated so seriously and so importantly, they can be mevatel halacha. One can take actual halacha, actual Jewish law, and actual minhag, and minhag can outweigh the notion of halacha itself. So we have these two very different perspectives and positions on minhagim. Now, the easiest response would be, okay, but these are two different people with two different views of minhagim, and these views are just representative of their broader perspectives on minhagim. Rabbeinu Tam dismisses minhagim, whereas the Rashba treats them with tremendous respect, which is not a crazy idea. There's a lot of situations in halacha and Jewish law where that's the case, where we just have two different opinions by two different people. But that's not a satisfactory answer, because there are many other occasions where Rabbeinu Tam defends the notion of minhag. In a lot of places, he's Rabbi Minhag. He really defends the existence of minhagim in communities. So it can't be that Rabbeinu Tam, source number one, is just representative of his position, and he doesn't treat minhagim seriously, because we know in other places, he does treat minhagim very seriously. So the correct understanding is to realize that when we use the term minhag, what's actually happening, and this is really what these shiurim are going to be about, we're really referring to many, many different things. The word may be minhag, it may mean custom, but really there are multiple different things that are meant by the word minhag. It's not actually, but it reminds me of the idea of a homonym. A homonym is a word in English that is spelt and pronounced exactly the same way, but means two completely different things. The most amusing example of a homonym, there's a cartoon, The Right to Bear Arms. So there's a picture of someone with the arms of a bear, because the Second Amendment preserves everyone's right to bear arms. The word bear is a homonym because it means both to take, to hold, as in one can hold arms in battle, but one can also, bear is also the animal. That's a homonym. And minhag isn't a homonym in that sense, but it means, we use the term minhag, but really it means multiple different things. What those different types of minhagim are, we'll have to wait to next week to kind of peer on and see the various different types of minhagim. But this week, what I really want to focus on is a better understanding of, so how do these minhagim develop? And how does Jewish law, how does halacha conceptualize them? How do we see the seriousness with which minhagim are treated, which will then allow us in the 2 weeks after next week to really start taking a look at a few key questions about minhagim. The final week will really answer maybe the central question of minhagim, which is which bind us and which do not, both as individuals, as communities, as shuls, which minhagim bind us and which don't. And the third week, we're going to focus on a very specific type of minhag, that is the nusach of tefillah, the liturgy itself, how that developed. We obviously are a shul that dams nusach Sfad, which is a variant almost of nusach Ashkenaz, so it's a really appropriate opportunity for us to discuss in detail the development of nusach Sfad and how that's understood as a minhag, and nusach Ashkenaz and all the other various nusachot as a whole. So that's kind of an introduction to the next few weeks. Next week we'll look at the different types of minhagim. The third week, nusachot of tefillah, liturgy. And then the fourth week, answering the crucial question of which minhagim bind us, do minhagim bind us, how do we understand that? But today we're going to look at how minhagim occur. Why do we need minhagim? What does it even mean that we have these customs? And at the same time, what maybe gives them a certain sense of importance in halacha? You had a question?
Very briefly, this would be a homonym, the right to bear arms. You have just two different definitions on the same word.
Wait, bear. No, bear is a homonym. The word bear.
It'd have to be spelled differently to be a homonym.
No, homonyms are spelled the same.
No, they sound the same.
No, I'm pretty... No, wait.
Homophone.
Yeah, no, this... Homonyms sound the same and are spelt the same. Homophones sound different and are spelt the same. And then there's another one. Whichever one it is, there are three words. There's words that are spelt differently, sound the same. Words that are spelt the same, sound different. And there's words that sound the same and are spelt the same. And that's the homonym.
Thank you.
I spent too much time Googling that. That was the most researched part of this year, guys. Honestly, after this, I'm just winging it. I wasted all my time researching homonym. The amount of Googling I had to do to find that example of bear.
To bear arms.
You had.
This is also a very small issue, but isn't the mafriyas to disturb? So could you read that as this is a minhag for those who are disturbing?
No, I think in this context it really means it's an anagram. That's the kind of the context. You're right, but the context here seems to be he's playing off the idea that it's an anagram. But it's clearly either way not a positive perspective on the word minhagim. So with that, let's try and understand where minhagim come from. So really, the best way to understand minhagim is minhagim start to occur at the point at which halacha ends. And to really understand what I mean by that, we have to have a very brief painting with a broad brush overview of how halacha itself works. Hopefully there'll be another time for another series to really focus in depth on the development and methodology of halacha. But for now, we'll just suffice with a very broad brush approach, which is that obviously we have fine Torah Shebechtav, the written Torah, and Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. And progressively that oral law gets canonized to a certain extent. So obviously, and we're gonna kind of pass over the canonization and the finishing of the Talmud, of the Gemara. But ultimately, after the Gemara exists, halacha develops through, broadly speaking, three different ways. Codes, commentaries, and questions. And what I mean by that is that whenever we are faced as Jews with practice, we need to know what are we supposed to do. How do we understand what to do in a given situation? Because if you look at the Gemara, it doesn't cover every single situation, so it needs to be translated into practical terms. And the way that's translated is either through codes, through commentaries, or through questions. So a code is simply a rule book of prescriptions. Do X, don't do Y, sometimes do Z. It literally is just a laundry list of all the things one needs to do and one can't do. The most famous examples of codes are perhaps the Rambam's Mishneh Torah and also the Shulchan Aruch, are classic examples of codes. They simply tell you what to do. A commentary, and the most famous examples of commentaries are probably that of Rashi and that of the Baalei Tosfot, is more interested, so it's fixed to a particular work, so a commentary, let's just focus on a commentary on, say, the Gemara and the Talmud. A commentary is more focused on explaining how one can understand what's going on in the Gemara. But through that explanation, it will describe a practice and how we're supposed to do it. So the example might be, and this is a very contrived example, but let's take an example like Netilat Yadayim, like washing one's hands. So a code will simply be to do Netilat Yadayim, you know, take water, go blah, blah, and describe exactly what it is and find that. You see that in the code. A commentary in contrast, say on the Gemara discussing Netilat Yadayim, Rashi will explain such as when one does blah, 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 which is, it's a very different, it's not telling you this is what must be done, it's not prescribing anything, it's merely describing the way something is done. But from that, we glean another normative perspective. So when someone says the Rambam's perspective is X, by and large, there are nuances to this, but by and large, they mean because you look up in the Rambam's code and the Rambam says, do X. X is this. In contrast, when someone says Rashi says you need to do X, well, that means that you've looked in Rashi's commentary and Rashi describes X a certain way, and that's how we know what Rashi believes. But that's codes and that's commentaries. One, a code is prescriptive, whereas a commentary is descriptive. And then the final one is questions. Questions and answers are about as old as they've ever been. And that, as old as Judaism itself, which is, how do you know what to do? You ask the rabbi. So throughout Jewish history, people have sent in questions to rabbis, and rabbis respond. So the Teshuvot, source numbers 1 and 2, you'll see they have in English, responsa, or shut, in Hebrew, which is she'elot u'tshuvot, which is questions and answers. That is the format that rabbis have often communicated matters of Jewish law. They get asked a specific question, and in response to that question, they delineate a specific law. And these are fascinating because they discuss very precise situations, unlike a code, which is far more expansive and in some ways far less detailed, and a commentary, which is constrained by what it's commentating on. Questions and answers are very specific based on the question that's given. But questions and answers, response literature, is reactive. It can only ever address an issue which is brought up to it. It can only ever address an issue. It can only ever react to an issue based on a question that it receives. And essentially what this brings, this process brings a continuing cycle. Throughout halacha is basically this cycle. Because what happens? Someone decides to write a code, a new code. And how do they write that code? Well, they base their code based on previous codes, based on previous commentaries, and based on previous questions and the answers that were given. And then on those codes, along comes commentaries, because commentaries start to be written on the codes, explaining all the details that aren't captured within that code itself. And then, oh, look what happened. The code and the commentaries don't seem to capture a specific issue that's being addressed in the Jewish world. So a question is sent off to a rabbi again, and so an answer is brought addressing a specific issue. And so the cycle continues over and over again. Codes, commentaries, and questions and answers are always cycling together to try and give us a sense of what Jewish law is. But in a sense, it's always one step behind. Because until something happens, you can't react to it and give an answer. You can't describe this is what people are doing. And you definitely can't prescribe it. You definitely can't tell people what they need to do until you've seen it and you can tell people whether or not they need to do it. And in a nutshell, this is exactly where minhagim step in. Because minhagim really step in this place, the codes, commentaries, and questions are in a sense reacting to but can't really capture. So in a couple of weeks' time, when we're discussing the nusachot of tefillah, prayer is a great example of this. We know we need to pray. We know we need to daven. But what does that look like? Well, it's up to minhagim. Minhagim come along and they give us these customs, tell us this is how you pray, this is what you say, this is what you say on specific times of the year, this is what you don't say. These are really dictated by minhagim. But at the same time, these customs then themselves generate further halachic discussions. Because once a custom appears, people react to it. People start to decide, well, this custom actually is no good. Or this custom is very good and it should be done. More and more people should do this custom. More and more people should follow this path and do what these people are doing. At the same time, people may choose to describe the custom that's being done now in a commentary or a code as something that's positive that's being done. And sometimes these customs themselves are then codified. So what I'm trying to say here is that there's a very it's very hard to really capture and point to a minhag, because very often minhagim become part of the halachic system. Either as being endorsed by the halachic system, suddenly they become things that people should do, or alternatively, they're now labeled by the halachic system as things that are terrible and should never be done. And you can just, you know, on Friday nights when I give my Divrei Halacha, there's been plenty of examples, particularly in the run-up to kind of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, of Minhagim that we do around Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which you'll see in the codes people are reacting to. So the custom of Kaparot, of waving either chickens or coins around the head, Shulchan Aruch does not like it. The Ramah defends it. The Ramah defends it because it's a minhag, because it's a custom that's been done. But the Shulchan Aruch reacts to it and does not think it's good to be done. So you see this delicate interplay of halacha reacting to minhagim. And that's really the first aspect that we're going to try and focus on and analyze this broad trend. That's really what these shiurim are really looking at, is these minhagim which come along and yet to see their role and limit in halacha. Because ultimately halacha reacts to these customs and then afterwards starts to decide, well, some of these customs aren't good, people shouldn't do them, they're terrible, maybe they violate certain prohibitions. And at the other time, halacha looks at certain customs that have developed and like, these are great, people should actually start to do this. And really next week we'll start to look at, when we start to splice the different types of minhagim, we'll really start to see concrete examples of those kinds of minhagim developing. But what I want to do for the rest of today is to try and gain a sense of the importance of minhagim. When we use the term minhag, when we refer to a minhag, what does that mean? In the halachic mindset, is there a, you know, what's the foundation upon which halachically a minhag rests? And to do that, we need to turn to source number 3. Which is a Mishnah in Masechet Pesachim, the Mishnah and the Gemara that follow. We're going to be looking at these Mishnayot and the Gemara that follow a few times during these series, because it's really the central discussion within the Gemara, the central Talmudic discussion about Minhagim. And the Mishnah says the following. Makom shenahagu la'asot melacha ba'arvei Pesachim ad chatzot osin. In a place where the custom is to perform melacha on Erev Pesach, they can do so. Until midday, they can do so. The context here is that Erev Pesach, there's a lot of things a person should be doing. They need to get rid of their chametz, they need to prepare for the Seder. There's a lot of different things a person needs to be doing in order to prepare for Pesach. So this Mishnah is describing a custom that developed in some communities to forbid melacha on Erev Pesach, in order to ensure that people were spending their time preparing for Erev Pesach. So our Mishnah begins by describing a community which does not observe this prohibition, a community in which people do perform melacha on Erev Pesach, and the Mishnah says, great, you can do that, no problem whatsoever. But then it says, makom shenahagu shelo la'asot, ein osin. But if you're in a community where it observed this custom to not perform melacha, you cannot do so. So we already see this idea here that depending on the community in which you're in, really reflects your ability to do or not do something on Erev Pesach. And then the Mishnah continues and says, Haholech mimakom she'osin. If one leaves a place where they do perform melacha on Erev Shabbat, lemakom she'ein osin, to a place where they don't, or mimakom she'ein osin, or you're going from a place where you don't observe, where you don't do malach on Erev Pesach, lemakom she'osin, to a place where they do, not nin alav chumrei makom she'yatzei misham, v'chumrei makom she'halach l'sham. You have to observe the stringencies of both communities. In other words, you can't do... what it means is, you can't do malacha in either situation. Let's say in Newton, we don't do malacha on Erev Pesach, but in Brookline we do. And you're now in Brookline for Erev Pesach, but you've come from Newton. So even though everyone else in Brookline is doing malacha on Erev Pesach, you cannot, because you came from Newton, and a place where you can't do malacha. So we already see this idea that one is obligated somehow in Minhagim, even when they're not in the place, which again we'll start to discuss next week and look at in the final week. But at the same time, if you move from Brookline to Newton, You came from a place where they do malacha to a place where you don't. You have to observe the chumra, which is the chumra is always to not do something.
Right.
So you can't do malacha even though you came from a place. So it's really teaching two very different principles. On the one hand, you're bound by the customs you came from. But at the same time, well, actually, no, you're not, because you're bound by whichever is more machmir. So we're not... Correct, whichever is more stringent. So we're not really going to unpack these details right now. We're going to save those for next week and the final week. But the idea here, which is really fascinating, just the final line of the Mishnah, the Al Yishne Adam Mipnei Hamachloket, and a person should not do something different so as to cause strife. There's questions over whether this is modifying the previous statements or whether it's just supporting the previous statements. But fundamentally what we see here is this notion of custom being codified into a halachic principle. This Mishnah is taking something, and it's not saying you must do the following. It's saying we accept that different customs have developed to do different things, but it's giving a certain legislative set of principles in order to govern how you must observe the minhagim. And it's fascinating because we see minhag is clearly not independent of halacha. It's being addressed in a Mishnah. It's being addressed in a Jewish law. It's being addressed and treated as having legal validity in some sense. And the question is why? Why should a minhag be treated as anything other than a custom? Why should it be treated with such seriousness? And there's really three different perspectives on why a minhag needs to be treated so seriously. We're going to look at those three perspectives today. The first is found in source number 4. So it's a comment of the Rosh, who is another one of the major medieval halachic authorities, who says the following, commenting on here. Adam shenahag isor bedava hamuta. Someone whose custom is to prohibit something that's permitted, lesayeg or lefrishet, in order to protect a prohibition, or for ascetic reasons. So again, we're not going to unpack these exact things until next week, but as we saw kind of the Mishnah in Pesachim, they're protecting Erev Pesach by prohibiting people from doing malacha. So that's kind of the sense here. It's a siag, it's a fence around the prohibition. It's a protection for the prohibition. The Rosh says about such a person, lo yatir lo hachacham haminhag hu, mimela dahave kamo neder. The reason is because it's as though it's a neder. It's a vow, it's an oath. The best translation of neder is the word neder, but that's also a very unhelpful translation because it's its own type of vow slash oath. But for our purposes, we need not get into the details of Nadarim, save for the fact that it's an oath. As we see in source number 5, which is taken from Parashat Matot, which is taken from the Torah, which says the following. Ish ki yedo neder l'Hashem. If a person makes a vow to Hashem, or hishava shvua le'esor isa al nafsha, or they take an oath imposing upon themselves an obligation upon themselves, lo yachel devara, you are forbidden from breaking your oath, all that you've enunciated, all that you've said, is binding for you. So we see the principle in the Torah of the notion of nedarim, and what the Rosh says here is that minhagim are nedarim. And source number 6 also, just to kind of support this idea further, so it's from the Gemara in Masechet Nedarim, which, no surprises, discusses the concepts of nedarim, of oaths. V'hatanya, Devarim hamutarim, things that are permitted, va'acherim nahagu bahen issa, but others are accustomed to prohibiting them for themselves, I ata rashai lahatiran bifnehem, you cannot absolve yourself of such a custom, shne'ema lo yachel devara, as we learn in that pasuk in source number 5, you cannot break your oath. So what we see here from the Rosh, and indeed this is one of the perspectives of minhagim, is a minhag is essentially a neder. When you are part of a community which accepts upon itself a certain, and again, next week we'll look at this particular nuance in detail, but specifically regarding things that we are prohibiting, things that otherwise would be permitted. So let's say you're in a community where the minhag is that even though it's permitted to eat apples, for whatever reason, I can't think of a good example, but we can imagine a good example, or probably not a very good example, knowing these kinds of things. But a good example has been created as to why to prohibit apples. You can't eat an apple, even if you move away from your community, because it's as though you made a neder. It's as though you made an oath to prohibit from yourselves the eating of apples. And Nadarim are treated incredibly seriously. Okay, we kind of say none of them apply on Yom Kippur. Let's just ignore that and pretend we never said anything on Yom Kippur so recently. But ultimately, Nadarim are really serious. By calling Minhagim Nadarim, that makes them incredible. They are oaths. We have sworn an oath before God to not do a particular thing, even though it's permitted. This, according to the Rosh and many others, is what a minhag is. It's an oath made and binding upon us. Yes.
If you're in a community that does, that has minhagim that are not ones that you came from, and you're following them out of respect for the community, and you specify, this is not my minhag, but out of respect for you, I'm doing this, have you then taken it on as...
So we will discuss those kinds of questions and more in the fourth share. I just like there's a lot of in order to really grasp Minhagim, there's really a lot of conceptual theory we kind of need to get through to be able to. So the answer is complicated enough that three shiurim from now we'll be like, yeah, that's a really, you know, relatively simple question to answer. But yeah, well, that's exactly the kind of questions we're going to be looking at in the fourth installment of this series. But yeah, that's a very relevant question, and we'll address it then. There's another option for potentially what Minhagim may be, and it comes from, again, the Rashba, one of the great medieval Rishonim, who says the following. So he's addressing in another response here. Take a look at source number 7. V'chol mi shenoheg issa bedava hamuta legada. Anyone who's accustomed to prohibiting for themselves something that's permitted as a protection, efshar shehu chamor min haneder v'hashvua, it's possible that this is more stringent than an oath or another kind of oath, a neder and a shvua, a vow or an oath. Shehanedarim v'hashvuat nish'alim aleihem umatirin lahem. Because with nedarim and shvuat and all these kinds of oaths, there is a mechanism by which one can be absolved. Again, we're not getting into the details, but Nadarim do possess an ability with which they can be reversed. Ve'elu, mi shenoheg iso bedvarim hamutarim. But regarding those people who are accustomed to prohibiting things that are permitted, kedei la'asot lo geder bifnei ha'iso, in order to bring some sort of protection from violating a prohibition, kiblu al atzman ki'isurin she'isartan ha'torah. She'ein lo heter li'olam. You've essentially created a new set of Torah prohibitions, and we can never absolve ourselves of Torah prohibitions. We can never. There's no mechanism by which we can say, "Oh, that Torah law doesn't apply. We don't need to observe it." They're always binding. The Rashba says these sorts of minhagim are binding on that level. They're far more stringent than nedarim, than oaths. Oaths you can reverse. Minhagim you can never reverse. Lefichach amru. Devarim hamutarin va'acherim nahagu b'hem issa nishal ein matirin lo. Things that are prohibited, things that are permitted but others prohibit them, you can't do anything about it. And it seems to be a quote from the previous source or from a source like it, but essentially the Rashba is saying these are treated far more seriously than nedarim, than oaths. And source number 8 kind of reveals, again, this is the Gemara that explains the Mishnah that was in source number 3, where the Gemara relates the following case, the following situation. B'nei Baishan. So we're going to just translate that as B'nei Baishan, because the question is, does it mean the children of a person named Baishan or the citizens of a town, Beit Shan, which we'll discuss week number 4, because it has tremendous ramifications on the halachic power of Minhagim, but we're going to ignore that entire thing for now. Anyway, Naihug de Lohavu Aslan Mitzor Litzidan Bema'ale Shabta. They would not travel from Tyre to Sidon to the market on Erev Shabbat. Similar reason to the Mishnah itself, because they don't want to violate Shabbat, so they wouldn't make this journey. Atu Banaihu Kame de Ravi Yochanan. So the later generations, I'm trying to leave it as ambiguously translated as possible, but the later generations come before Rabbi Yochanan. Amrullah. Avhatin efshalahu, anan lo efshalan. For the previous generations, they could do this. They made enough money, clearly, from the markets during the rest of the week. They could afford to take Erev Shabbat off. We can't. We need the money. We no longer make things. Things are no longer as good as they used to be. Amalahu, Rabbi Yochanan turned around and responded to them. Kvar kiblu avotechem aleihem. Shne'ema, Shema b'ni, Musar avicha, v'al titosh, tarat imecha. What your ancestors kind of accepted upon yourself is also binding upon you, as it says, and he quotes a verse from Proverbs, Shema b'ni, Musar avicha, v'al titosh, tarat imecha. My son, hear your father's rebuke, and do not abandon your mother's teaching, which is kind of understood in some sense as positing two different forms of laws that must be observed. You have the Musar avicha and the tarat imecha. One of which is fine, you have to actually observe halacha itself, but the other one is the tradition, is the customs you've taken upon, and they are just as binding and just as important to hearken towards as Torah law itself. So in this situation, Rabbi Yochanan says, no, you can't be absolved. It is more stringent than a neder, it's more stringent than an oath. There's no way for you to get out of this kind of custom. There's no way for to absolve yourselves of this kind of custom because previous generations or your ancestors accepted it upon themselves, and now therefore there's no getting out of it. It's if it were a neder, which we thought was stringent enough, no, there's actually something even more stringent, and that's Shema b'ni Musar avicha v'al titosh tarat imecha. But there is perhaps an even more strict approach to what powers minhagim. There's an even stronger argument to be made for the seriousness with which minhagim should be treated. And this argument is advanced by Rabbi Baruch Simon. Rabbi Baruch Simon is a Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University, a tremendously brilliant encyclopedic mind. He has a sefer that came out relatively recently on minhagim. And he starts by talking about minhagim as being within the rubric of the prohibition of chukat hagoy, of following the other nations. The Torah says, and it's in Parashat Achrei Mot, source number 9, in Sefer Vayikra, "Kema'aseh eretz Mitzrayim asher yeshavtem ba, lo tasu, you shall not copy the practices of the land of Egypt where you dwelt, u'chema'aseh eretz Kana'an asher ani mevia etchem shama, you can't follow the law, the practices of the people of Kana'an where you will be brought to, lo tasu u'v'chukotechem lo teilechu, you shouldn't follow their laws." So this is known more colloquially as chukat hagoy, the prohibition of not being able to do the things that non-Jews do. Now this raises a tremendously large area of halacha, which is what's the scope of this prohibition? Does it mean literally anything? So for instance, before Jews were wearing ties, non-Jews were wearing ties. So is this a violation of, and I've heard it not necessarily from a most reliable source, but there are some members of the Chabad community who don't wear ties because they believe it's a violation of Chukat HaGoy. Is wearing a soccer jersey or an NFL jersey a Chukat HaGoy because it's not an intrinsically Jewish thing, it's something that came about through another custom. What's the scope? So it's a fascinating discussion, the details of which we'd have to discuss another time, but one really interesting example of this was doctors. Doctors used to wear, I guess, some medieval version of scrubs, which made them identifiable as being doctors. And the question became, as the non-Jews are dressing as doctors, what about Jews? There's always been Jewish doctors. So what about Jewish doctors? Can they dress as non-Jewish doctors? Or are they violating Chukat HaGoy? Are they following other nations? So again, it's a very rich discussion. But to kind of capture the essence of Chukat HaGoy, we have this comment by the Ramah of Moshe Isserles, who's the defining rabbi for Ashkenazi Jewry, who says the following, discussing Chukat HaGoy. V'chol ze, eino aso, it's source number 10. V'chol ze, eino aso, ela bedava shenahaguba ha'ovde kochavim, l'shem pritzot. This is only regarding things that non-Jews do for the sake of licentiousness. Immodesty, impropriety, it's only regarding things that they do for inappropriate reasons. Kagan, shenahagu lilbosh malbushim adumim. For example, they are accustomed to wearing red clothing. Vehu malbush sarim uchaduma lazemi malbushay hapritzut. And this is an example of things which are, you know, inappropriate clothing. So by the way, just as a complete sidebar, the classic prohibition of wearing red clothing, which is often kind of touted as a really dumb example of halacha, it's clearly a contextual thing, which was back in the day when these laws were formed, red was an inappropriate color to wear. Whether it's, again, it says here, kamosh vehu malbush sarim, which one translation is this is kind of the clothing of like princes or wealthy people. So exactly how that translates to immodest, I'm not sure. It's a detail that's not worth getting into. But broadly speaking, the Ramah says, chukat hagoy is only dressing inappropriately like non-Jews do, as in you're basically violating a prohibition anyway by dressing as non-Jews do. Or, so we're now with the fourth line down in the middle after the column in the Hebrew, or bedavar shenahagu leminhag ulachok, Ve'en ta'am bedava de'ika lamechash ba mishum darchei ha'emori v'sheyesh bo shemetz avodat kochave me'avoteichem, or something that has no reason behind it. It's a custom or a statute of non-Jewish nations, and there's no reason behind it except we're worried that maybe there's an element of idolatry behind it. That's what Chukat Hagoy governs. The two things, immodest, acting immodestly, copying the immodest actions of other nations, that kind of makes sense. And the other one is the meaningless customs, where the only possible reason behind them is that they are doing it because of some aspect of Avodah Zarah or the like. Those are the only two types of customs which are a violation of Chukat HaGoy. Aval, dava shenahagu l'toelet, kugon shedarkan mikol shehu rofe, mumche yesh lo malbush miyuchad shenikobash hu rofe uman, muta l'lavsha. So for instance, but an example like a doctor wearing his doctor's clothing, that's not a violation of Chukat HaGoy because there's clearly a purpose behind it, and it's not an Avodah Zarah purpose. There's nothing immodest behind it. The purpose, the entire purpose of that custom for doctors to dress a specific way, so people know that they're doctors, so there's no worry of immodesty, and there's no worry of idolatry. That's, in a nutshell, the prohibition of Chukat HaGoy. You can only not do the meaningless, nonsensical customs of non-Jewish, of other nations, because we're worried it may be idolatry, but the core thing is, you just can't do the meaningless, nonsensical customs. Argues Rav Simon, there is then the flip side to this, which is just as we are forbidden from doing the meaningless customs of other nations, so we are effectively, and I may be putting words into his mouth here, but we are effectively obligated in the meaningless customs of Jews themselves. Chukat HaGoy has its reverse positive command of minhag, which is just as we can't do meaningless customs of other nations, so too we should do the meaningless customs of our own. And this is an even higher bar to set for minhagim. On the first level, they were oaths, which are very serious and very important, but have a reverse mechanism. You can always absolve yourself of an oath. The second possibility was it's quoted a pasuk, Shema b'ni Musar Avicha ve'al titash Torah Temecha, which almost equates it with Torah itself, with halacha itself, which places the role of minhagim on an even more important level. And finally, the most stringent approach is that even the meaningless minhag, which by next week we'll kind of get a better sense of what meaningless minhagim are, but even the meaningless minhag has an element to which it should be observed. And these are the three different ways one can conceive of minhagim to try and understand their seriousness. But what we're going to have to do this year is going to end perhaps slightly earlier than next week's war. Next week there's a lot to get through, so it may take a bit longer, but this year is going to end slightly earlier. But what we're going to have to start doing next week is taking a look at the different types of minhagim. Now we understand, again, why they're treated seriously, why they're treated by different people so seriously in different levels. It's almost, we're still back at the point that we were right at the beginning of the shiur, where we saw two different positions on minhagim. One is minhagim are awful, one is minhagim are important. Now we've seen three different positions on the seriousness of minhagim, but what we'll start to see next week is that, well, when we start to understand that there are different types of minhagim, we've not looked at it too much in detail, but we've seen the idea that a minhag that's created to protect a prohibition is one type of minhag, but we'll start to see other types also next week. We'll start to be able to realize that these different types of minhagim themselves are treated with different levels of seriousness. Some are indeed sacred practices that must be observed and can never be abrogated, and others are stupid customs, are things that make no sense, and there is no reason whatsoever to observe them. And so next week, we'll start to look in detail at some of the key types of minhagim that crop up in our Jewish lives, and the different levels of seriousness, the different levels of seriousness with which they must be treated. So that's going to be next week, the same time, the same place, Tuesdays at 7:45. I look forward to hopefully seeing everyone here again this time next week. And if anyone has any questions, any comments, please feel free to ask them right now. Just one final thing that I will say is in terms of feedback. I really appreciate any feedback, any constructive feedback. People don't need to insult me for no apparent reason. I get enough of that from Ruthie. So, but if there's any constructive feedback, you know, the only way these shiurim can improve and these shiurim can be more enjoyable for people is if I know ways in which I can make them more enjoyable. So people should please feel free to give me feedback. that I can listen to and take on board and to try and improve the shiurim for the next time around.